So if there's no other questions, we'll introduce who we have.
Thank you.
So we have Rachel. Rachel Butler comes from the Tiny House community in Bristol. As director and founder, Rachel is on a mission to enable the creation of genuinely affordable nature-based housing communities where social justice, inclusion and environmentally sound living are the norm. Tiny House Community Bristol was the first local tiny house community to come out of the UK tiny house movement. So we've got Joe Brunswick from the New Economics Foundation.
And the London Renters Union.
Union. Thank you. And we have Becky Jensen from the Bristol Vehicles for Change.
That's not your name.
Becky is co-founder of the newly formed community group, Bristol Vehicles for Change, focused on developing vehicle-based living options that are environmentally low-impact, community-led and affordable. And we have Tony Gosling from... From BAM.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry, the description of the Bristol Housing Action Movement I don't have here.
I'm quite happy to, yeah. If you give me a microphone.
Okay, thanks. Bristol Housing Action Squatting Group reset up in the 1980s, early 1980s. I don't know how many people we house every year, but certainly a lot of people. And I mean, there's a bit of a boom time with empty buildings. So the other thing, I was involved in the 1990s with George Monbiot for My Sins, with the Land Is Ours campaign, doing some quite spectacular land occupations. The other thing I do is as a radio broadcast journalist. So that's me.
We have Tom Morton here from ACON, and you are also a PhD student in community-led design at the Open University. ACON supports and enables communities and individuals to organize around unjust housing situations and collectively bring about change. We also have Susan Capelli from the Community-Led Homes West, which provides and support and advisory service to individuals, groups and professionals who are interested in community-led housing. Yeah, I've got too many bits of paper. So I'm just going to introduce this housing fishbowl and then I'm going to start a question off and we're going to kick off. So thank you for your patience, guys. So, fishbowl one, housing. We are living in a housing crisis and the government is mostly responding by promising to build more homes. They are under pressure from big house builders to make it easy to build new car-reliant homes on greenfield land with minimal requirements for energy efficiency. What are the other ways to make housing affordable for all? What are the real root causes of the housing crisis? Join grassroots activists, who we've all introduced, everybody, who have a critical analysis of the housing crisis and possible solutions for open discussion, exploring these and other ideas. First question, or do you want me to? So we have the first question is, what is the relevance of land ownership to access to housing for those at the sharp end of the housing crisis? Those that are homeless, those that find it hard to access rented accommodation or want alternative ways to live, who have no choice to accept poor living conditions.
Hi everybody. So the first thoughts I have that have popped up to the first question are that during the enclosure of lands around the UK, sort of over 100 or so years ago now, some of you might know a lot more about this than I do, but it seems that the common person was driven off their land and sort of forced into the city, into the cities and towns. The main big tranches of lands were enclosed and then get off my land is sort of common. So people were driven into towns and cities, and people trying to make a living in the cities. And as we all know now, that living in the city is rapidly becoming completely not possible for a growing sector of society. Hence why many of us are here today. Access to land and affordable land is absolutely key for the creation of genuinely affordable housing, which is why I'm really pleased that the council are looking to dispose of land to community-led housing groups. And using a social value calculator, if your scheme has high social value, a group might be able to get a piece of land for £1. So that then enables it all to start happening, which is fantastic. And that's my contribution. Thank you. Yeah. Susan, come on.
Thanks for that, Rachel. I just want to add to that stream is that, as Rachel was saying, that the land disposal is happening, and Bristol City Council have got 19 pieces of land that are becoming available, and as Rachel rightly said, it will be for self-build and community groups. And as she said, there may be an opportunity, and this is all around social value, so those that have the best idea or the social value, it will deduct the value of the land. So that is happening on March, and I just want to give some dates that on March the 4th. And at the Hub, we will be putting those bits of land and helping support those and getting individuals and community groups, letting them see those pieces of land so that you can have a look. So we would welcome, we're going to be doing something at the Engine Shed on the it will be on the 11th of March, yeah, so there'll be more details, and I'll be leaving some information here later on.
Okay, I'd like to start again by saying that the earth is a free gift to mankind, and why on earth should anybody be paying anything to be somewhere? We've seen with the latest proposals from this government trying to make travellers and itinerants criminals, and this is just simply a way of driving people into paying for every second of the day that they've got somewhere permanent. Now, there's two ways of dealing with this. You either knuckle down and get an income to pay that, or else you become an itinerant. And they're making it as almost impossible to be itinerant. I love what this lady here said about the enclosures. If anyone hasn't got the best way, I think, to understand our history, because a lot of this is history we don't get taught, is this £1 Wordsworth Dictionary of British History, which is a terrific little guide to some of the changes that there have been over the centuries. And the most important thing is, of course, that the enclosures happened after the English Civil War, pretty much. I mean, they'd started a bit before. The Civil War played a key role in accelerating enclosure, which was just privatisation of land. And so we became the first country on the planet to go for mass urbanisation. We're now in the situation today where our cities have lost their real purpose, which was to bring people together in one place to work in industries. And, I mean, particularly up north, you've got whole cities that have lost their reason to be there. So we need to really understand, I think, how to get back into... we've got about 60 million acres and about 65 million people, so each person should have an acre. If you're just looking at land justice, where is my acre, I'm often thinking. And the idea is to stop people having access to that, and that seems to be very effective from a legal point of view. We've got developments going on in this city at Temple Island, they used to be called Arena Island, it's now Temple Island, and we've got also Western Harbour. These developments are simply led by the worst rich people you can find. The City of London basically goes to the mayor wants things built, and the mayor says, well, what can I do for you? And so when I say that, it's because this is rentier money, the rentier economy. People that invest in something, do absolutely nothing to contribute to society, and take rent from it. So they're basically gatekeepers for us to have access to what we should have access to freely. There's no, you know, the manufacturing and the service industries in this country are collapsing, and what is booming is the rentier economy. So people who are just using their money to stop ordinary people having access to the things that they basically need. Now, this is all enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 20. Everyone should have a right to. That means they don't have to pay for it. It's a right to water, shelter, food, employment. All these basic things should be there as a right. And if we don't fight for it, I'm afraid we're going to end up in a sort of rentier's prison where everybody is paying just to live, and that the landowners, the owners of the property we're in, are just racking up the rent as fast as they can. And that's the world we're in, and that's, I suppose, why I think it's so important that we've got people on the outside, squatters and van dwellers, canal dwellers, and people who are making sure that we're not all ending up in some little tiny box paying a massive amount just to live. So anyway, that's my thought about land ownership. I don't actually really believe in land ownership. I think ownership is something of something maybe you've made or something physical, but the land is there for everyone. We just need to be very good at organising how we distribute it. And that's happened a lot, but very successfully in the past, particularly with the commons, which are managed through stints. Well, everyone agrees, you can do this and I can do that. And that was what was extinguished. Well, there's still a bit of it around, but largely with enclosure. So I'll finish there.
Just a little bit, really, like on the practical side of like land ownership for lots of people who live in vehicles. For us, obviously, it's the biggest issue because we already have our house. You know, our house is ready to go, but when we've been trying to, you know, take ourselves off the roadside for people who want to create communities, what the council calls sites, it's almost impossible because land is held hostage by councils, by landowners, by companies as investment opportunities, which means that for us to do something that's really low impact, affordable, would address the climate crisis, would address the housing crisis, would increase biodiversity with growing projects, would help us grow our own food, all those sort of things. We have the housing ready to go. We just need the land to put the housing on so that we can develop these communities. But the issues around you know, the lack of access to land in any form means that actually it's really hard for us to establish communities that we want because we just can't access the land in the first place.
So I'm just going to throw in a quick question. Well, you can answer that or you can carry on this conversation and it kind of might link in. I was just going to ask, are empty homes caused by unfair access to land?
Thanks. I mean, we started with some solutions and also the problem. I thought it might be useful to kind of describe the challenge as I see it. So I think what we're trying to fight here is what's called the financialization of land. So that's the treatment of land as a financial asset. Land can have many different roles in society, has and does, but its primary role in many societies nowadays is as a financial asset. What does that mean? It means that the value of all the land in the UK at the moment is £5 trillion, more than half of the net worth of the country. So if you added up everything of financial value in the UK, then more than half of it will be land. So land is so expensive, and what that means is that that price places a barrier on socially useful uses of that land. We're obviously talking about housing, and so what that means in terms of housing is that the cost of building a house, you look at a house, we call it a house, we don't call it a land, but it's not the bricks and it's not the construction which costs the majority of the money. Up to 70% of the cost of a house is the cost of the land. So at the New Economics Foundation, NEF, we did some research last year and looked at the role that land prices play in like delivering social rented housing, the only type of housing that's affordable for people on the lowest incomes, and found that in the councils in the areas of the country with the highest land prices between 2010 and 2015, the amount of social housing we were building had dropped by 80%. Whereas in the rest of the country with less high land prices, the amount of social housing we were building would drop by 20%. So it's clear that the price of land, the financialization of land that we've allowed to happen over the last 4 or 5 decades, is the driver of the housing crisis.
Just a snippet that I picked up on last night via Twitter is there's a new film out called Push, and I believe it's available on Vimeo, and the UN rapporteur for housing and something else, I can't remember her name, sorry, but Leilani
Faha.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so she's, it looks like she's travelled the world and has discovered that this is not a UK problem, it's international, it's pretty much every city, big city around the world. So I tried to watch it last night, but it's not available in our region yet. Watch the trailer, it looks really, really good. And it looks like if we drop her a message, we might be able to get it released in our region. So I think that's going to be a really powerful film to watch. And that's it. Thank you.
Hi, you're right. I just saw an opportunity, basically, to introduce Acorn and maybe how we fit into this conversation. I don't know if we've got any Acorn members in the room. I'm sure of hands. I'll be coming around to sign everyone else up who didn't put their hands up. So people think of us as a tenants' union or a housing union. We're actually a community union, and for a lot of the reasons that we're hearing discussed this morning, particularly in Beth's presentation, which was great, thank you. A lot of the work we do is around housing, because, you know, housing kind of, and land is the economy, and the people at the sharp end of that economy, housing and land is how they interact with a lot of the kind of social injustice that we experience. There's a load of expertise in the room and on this kind of fishbowl in particular. A lot of, people are either kind of community self-helpers, right? So you're kind of providing housing for communities that need it or for the people that you can access. And then some people are at the top level of like policy and kind of and what we can do at the top level to mitigate some of these problems. Where Acorn fits in is how do we get there, right? Because something that has kind of been missing from the conversation is that like the housing crisis isn't an accident, right? And it isn't a force of nature. Like inequality and social injustice and land injustice is about power, and it's about who's got power and in whose interest power is used in. So our interest is to build oppositional power to private finance, to the private profiteers who own our land and who own our houses, and establishment politics. And the way that we build that power is through a union model. So we are a membership fees paying, dues paying union. That's how we stay independent. It means we can take anybody on who we need to, but we're also democratic and member led in that sense. So the way I see Acorn fitting into this conversation is, yes, you guys know that we need access to land to be able to, you know, build self-help into the communities and build resilient communities. And there are people from NEF and so on who've got the top end policy of how we do that. Acorn is about how do we win the power that enables us to do that. And that's how we fit into this conversation, because the people at the top of our society know what the solutions to these problems are for us, but they don't really want to help us do it. And so we've got to build strong enough communities, organised communities, that can force them to do it for us. And that's kind of how I think we fit into this conversation.
I've got a question for you then, Tom.
Hello.
our group is currently working with a private landowner who's really loving what we're doing. And we're working with her to transfer the ownership of parts of her land to, well, either going to be a community benefit society or community interest company or Bristol Community Land Trust at a very discounted rate. And the two of us, me and the landowner, are going to be giving a talk at Froom Tiny Homes Show next month about how we're working together to make this happen. So we feel that part of our work is to highlight to other private landowners how they might also like to join in the party. And, you know, because I think rather than completely demonising all the landowners, I think really helpful to... Hello. Really helpful to open up a really open conversation with no pointy fingers at landowners and say, this is what we're doing. Would you be interested in doing something similar? What do you think?
Yeah, so open conversation's great. Getting people at a negotiating table is great. But we need to be at that negotiating table with power to negotiate. This is a fundamental problem. So there are all kinds of policies that have opened up collaboration and negotiation. The Tory party in 2012 introduced the Localism Act, right, that granted kind of communities new powers to lay claim to public community assets as they saw it, and spaces in the community and so on. But the difficulty is that we're going up against like the most powerful people in the world, right? You know, the people who control land and control resources have got more power than us to achieve their aims. So we need to, absolutely, yeah, I will go into, as with my union, go into any negotiations with anybody about how we can move forward, but we need to be entering into those negotiations with power. And the way we build that power is by having people join the union and build power within those communities, right? Because obviously, yeah, there are honourable exceptions who are willing to kind of work amicably with communities and aren't just interested necessarily in just lining their pockets. But ultimately, that's unaccountable philanthropy. It's at the whim of whoever owns the land to do it. And that's not good enough, because what we're talking about is structural problems. These aren't individual problems. We're talking about structural problems, and we need structural solutions to it and go right to the source of the problem. And the only way we're going to do that is by building power in our communities through community unions. So, yeah, it's not about demonising landlords or landowners. If they treat their tenants with respect and let them live in dignity and secure and decent homes, then they've got like nothing to worry about. But if they don't do that, then maybe they should be worried, right?
Can I just directly on that point?
If you want a negotiation, turn up on someone's land, then you have a negotiation. Our occupations were a lot of fun in the 1990s, and we got to meet face to face some of the worst landowners, as well as some fairly reasonable people. Now, these are people who are used to the money rolling in. They're not used to having to discuss whether or why that money is rolling in. And as part of the discussion, also, I think, to get the intellectual side of it and the policy side of it, land value taxation is a good point to discuss, because there are all sorts of whether to tax land or not, there are all sorts of points for and against it. And this is a discussion I don't think we've really properly had in this country. Is land something that we want to tax or not? Because if we do, that means that people will be making decisions about that land based on how much money they're going to be making on that land. Do we tax basic essentials or do we tax luxuries? These sorts of questions we can tease out. And there is a big movement in this country to say, in fact, Winston Churchill was very pro-land value tax or pro-land tax. So these discussions have not been had yet, and so we can tease those out, I think. But turn up on someone's land, and then you can start negotiating with them.
Hi everyone, my name is Hugh, and I work for a small building firm called the Bristol Sustainable Building Company, and what we do is sustainable retrofit, which for anyone who doesn't know, just basically is a fancy word for improving houses, upgrading houses that already exist, that are already standing but are performing badly, in a lot of cases incredibly badly, and are not healthy, vibrant, durable places to live. And I come into the circle because I'm throwing another hat into the ring, which I think is a part of the solution to this. I think it's a big part of the solution. It was written into the Labour manifesto, sustainable retrofit. I think to subsidise and sustainably retrofit every residential home in the UK by 2040 or 50, I'm not quite sure, so you can check that. But I think this is an absolutely massive, I feel really passionately about this, because and we do that, by the way, all from a point of view of sustainability, which just basically involves different materials and different methods to your like standard retrofit building firm. But otherwise, we're quite similar in what we do, what we aim to do, but from quite a different standpoint. But yeah, so retrofit, we need more housing. We need more housing. We cannot square a growing population and a liberal and peaceful immigration policy with not having more housing. But we have so much already that is already there, and it's always talked about building more housing and getting more homes because it always fits in with our model of economic growth. But we have so much that is there that is not performing, that is not serving people, that is not fit for purpose. And we have loads of houses. Easton is chock full of houses. I walk into every single house, and Easton is built on a lot of ex-mining, there's massive subsidence, there's damp, there's places that are just not fit for purpose for tenants that are fleecing people of their money. And we now have the knowledge, we have the technology, we have the capability to understand building for the science that it is. Building should be not something that you pick up as a tradesman from your old man. It should be a degree that is studied, that is understood, because we now know how to build houses that will last for a really long time, that will be energy efficient and cheaper to run, that will create a healthy environment. And we know how to do that with materials that don't cost the earth. Those materials are now competitive with conventional, you know, natural insulation, sheep's wool, wood fibre is increasingly becoming competitive with synthetic, artificial insulation. And we have the ability to do this. Now, clearly this is not enough. We also need legislation to put in rent caps to legislate against derelict buildings, but we should use what we have. We should upcycle what is already there. It's not all about building more and finding, you know, ways to create new residential properties when there is 90% of what is standing in the UK could be so much better built, and we can do that, so we should.
I just wanted to come in on that, because more and more recently I've been thinking that, you know, the demand, the like central demands of like the housing movement in the UK are, you know, increasingly incompatible with the central demands of the climate movement. And so, you know, the Shelter did a report recently outlining that the scale of need for social housing in this country is 3.2 million new homes, and that, you know, the scale of the housing crisis means that, you know, we need to, it appears, build millions and millions of new homes at affordable prices with secure tenancies very quickly. But construction is actually one of the most carbon-intensive industries in the country. And so how do we square that with the need to decarbonise our economy within 10 to 15 years? I think this is a massive question which people aren't really looking into. Hopefully at work we'll be able to start to do some thinking on this reasonably. Retrofit is going to be is certainly going to be a part of the solution. But, you know, the housing crisis is normally talked about as a numbers game, and hopefully Beth's presentation earlier shed a few doubts about that. It's not the do we have enough homes? No, we will always need to build homes. But is it the question of the housing crisis is best understood as a problem of tenure, not necessarily as a problem of supply. So we don't have enough homes that are secure and affordable. And so one of the ways that we can start to think about how we can solve the housing crisis in a climate-compatible way is converting the homes that we already have to secure and affordable tenancies. And, you know, naturally, the least secure, least affordable homes in the country are in the private rented sector. And what we need is more social rent and housing. So is there a role for the government to start buying en masse private rented sector housing, retrofitting it to sustainable standards and converting it to social housing? Sounds very attractive. There's huge problems with that, because if the government became a massive buyer of housing, it's going to have huge effects on the housing market. So we need to think very seriously about that. But I think that's the kind of scale of, like, problem solving that we need to do in order to make solving the housing crisis compatible with climate change.
Yeah, I totally agree that that's a massive convergence of things that need to happen. And I would say there's like a material that does that, which is hemp. It's like the plant that grows fastest in a temperate climate. It can sequester 8 times more carbon than a forest in the same period of time, and fortunately builds fantastic houses as well. It's a great tool for retrofit, and all the new build that we need to do is actually a way of locking carbon up in the built environment rather than expending it in order to build in these frankly ridiculous materials like concrete, steel, glass. Like, they're just representing an expenditure to the world and to the commons. And you know, hemp, wood, these carbon-rich materials, they're actually doing the job that we need to do so badly of sucking the carbon out of the air and sequestering it in the terrestrial biosphere. And yeah, so I'd say in that list of materials you're using for retrofit and for the new build, like, hemp has got to be like right at the top of it, and we should be growing it everywhere. That wasn't actually the point that I wanted to make, and if anyone wants to talk about hemp, like, I can talk about it for months on end pretty much without breathing, so I'm here. But it kind of ties in as well, because something I got really excited about and the sort of point that was made, that the fundamental cost and the barrier to housing being built is the price of land. And then looking at the One Planet development policy that exists in Wales as a really good model of how we can build new houses in a model that is actually compatible with the needs of the planet, and incentivise a mode of living that is also like that as well. And I got really excited when I found out at the Oxford Farming Conference, Real Farming Conference, back in last month, that the Forest of Dean and Dartmoor have, on a local planning authority level, basically taken that policy and implemented it on a regional level. So I think there's great opportunities for people to get together and find, like, you know, on a local level, to find councils that are up for doing that, and lobbying them and saying, you know, this is the kind of thing, and demonstrating what can happen in that way of being. And it's, you know, I think that's what needs to happen now, is demonstrating that from a grassroots, bottom-up style, that we can build carbon negative housing that incentivizes this kind of, you know, connection to the land and a way of being like that. And it seems like it's really possible now, because 2 local authorities are taking that on. There's many more that could take that on. And yeah, it's just a bit of a shout out to kind of lobby our councils when the local, you know, when the local plan is being considered and those consultations are on, to like to really push hard for that to be something that is adopted, because I think that could be the sort of big change that we need, of people coming out of cities that don't really make sense, going back to the land and locking up loads of carbon in houses built out of cannabis.
Thanks very much for that. And I just wanted to add to that, and following on from that, and what you've just said is really music to my ears, because all the things that we're exploring tap into all of that. So what I'm learning is that our future potentially is bioregional. We have to see what we can, the resources to build our houses need to be within our bioregion that we can access easily. Hemp could be a huge part of this, and my next thinking is to start talking to local landowners to see if they will start growing the hemp that we need to build our houses. Currently hemp is within something like drug and firearms policy with central government, which is mad, but anyway, I can sort of bypass that. But so it's about bioregional. We have to think in systems ways as well, because everything is interconnected. And if we think in silos, then we might only be creating more problems in other areas. So, yeah, donor economics as well. Got to get onto that.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm David. I'm a frustrated carpenter. I'd like to be building natural houses at prices that people can afford, but I'm also a hacker. And I want to, first of all, a one-word shout-out about materials, bamboo, also. So I'm a hacker, and I'm currently hacking the energy system with a community solar project. And really good hackers are not quite as good as the most brilliant hackers. Brilliant hackers produce really original ideas. Really good hackers steal them from other people and implement them. And I want to describe a hack that's been developed by two guys in Bridport on housing. And what they've done is they are not buying land from a farmer, and they're going to build super affordable housing that's carbon sequestering and that exports renewable energy, and it's going to rent for around £100 a week. And the hack is that they're not buying the land at the prices that Barrett would do, but they're buying it from the farmer at a price higher than he would get for agricultural land. In fact, they're leasing it from him. It's about, you know, up to £10,000 an acre, but with 10 homes an acre, that's only £1,000 a year, right? So that's okay. And what they're doing is they're getting planning permission on the land by virtue of going to the council and saying, we're going to build housing on this land that's completely affordable. Can we have planning permission? And the council says, well, if you were Barrett, we'd say no, but if it's totally affordable, we can't say no. So the hack is squaring the circle on buying up land or leasing the land cheaply for communities. It's exactly what you were saying, Rachel. For this is a rural hack that can work for eco-villages, where you go to the farmer, you lease the land off him, and then you run it community-supported agriculture as an eco-village. And the urban hack is to go to the council and say, we're going to create so much social value that we don't buy the land off you.
Thank you. That's a really interesting vision. I just wanted to respond to Hugh's comment about retrofitting. I'm an architect based in Bristol, and I've just renovated a house in Easton to make it energy efficient, and it's actually quite expensive to make a really energy efficient house out of a terrace. Victorian Terrace House. So I wanted to share a solution that could work in terms of the economics. So I'd be interested to hear from economics specialists on this. It's an idea of an energy mortgage. So you'd borrow money to pay for the refurbishment of your house, and then you'd pay back the loan over the years from the money that you're saving by not having to pay such expensive gas bills. So I think that's something that we should also be lobbying for or campaigning for. I also wanted to make a point about materials, and I think we can get obsessed. I think hemp's great and I think bamboo's great, but I think we should look at the whole life cycle analysis of the materials and their performance, so we don't just obsess over one material. I think we should look at all the options, look what's local and what's going to provide airtight and super insulated houses. And I also think we need to remember to ventilate houses when we make them airtight and insulated. Okay, thanks.
I'm really interested in how a lot of these solutions that have been expressed in this lovely fishbowl are sort of reconciled in the planning system. So we've heard that there's cities that, I'm sure some of the residents would disagree, but don't need to exist anymore as a city, or there's the original reasons for that city coming into existence no longer exists. And people then talking about, setting up micro homes in I get it sounds like more rural environments. So I'm kind of like, I can see the reasons for wanting to set up a micro home in a rural environment. I've actually done it myself. But there are some sort of environmental issues with it. In my experience, transport, often sort of living more remotely to a town or a city can sort of introduce like, I'm currently burning quite a lot of carbon in my car to do that. And I could probably improve that by getting an electric bicycle or something. But anyway, also energy and infrastructure, how that's implemented. Like if you go to CAT, they'll pretty much just straight up tell you that, you know, being like off grid or anything like that, which a lot of the time is sort of, I think we have quite utopian ideas of being off grid because you're sort of being self-supporting and stuff. But I think actually in terms of energy efficiency and the sort of the energy involved in creating all the sort of little micro versions of like inverters and transformers and stuff, like is actually like a much higher than like living together in a sort of town or something. I can imagine that there is probably a scale of dwelling that might not be a city, and it might not be living in the middle of nowhere, and it might look something like a village or a town. But certainly we can't get rid of the towns very of big cities very easily, and I think we have to like look at housing in the sort of larger economy, the jobs that we're doing. Are we all wanting to become farmers and grow our own food? I mean, that sounds great, but I'm not sure it's going to happen. Currently we've got a very small workforce that working on the land. It would be nice if that did increase, because there are a lot of issues with industrialised agriculture, and hopefully we can get some more small-scale agriculture. But yeah, I kind of raises more questions than answers. But, yeah.
Can I just make a point here?
Just a quick point on that is that for us, we don't see us being a gated off-grid, building off gated off-grid communities. We see that there's opportunity for creating symbiotic relationships with towns and cities and villages, where you place communal facilities on the boundaries between your new communities and the existing communities. You share those spaces between, you have intermingling, and to help reignite local economies particularly. And if you're doing that within a bioregion, you're creating a symbiotic relationship with a town or a village or a city, then it hopefully helps to create a much more balanced community. And yeah, if you're connected to the grid, then you can benefit from that also. And hopefully things can scale out from there.
I'm Mark. I've got this crazy idea, and I was going to call it Help Me, Housing Enablement, Local Provision Made Easy. Where's the money? The money's in your house, greatly, if you're an owner-occupier. And if you're not, it's the only place it's probably is in your pension scheme. So my theory is to utilise those pension schemes actually to build housing. So actually what you do is you invest your assets locally in housing. But the key solution I see is actually you put down your kind of 10% after you've put together with a group of other people and the pension. And then you go to government and say, we're trying to facilitate our own housing via the pension scheme. And the government can borrow money phenomenally cheaply. And in 2017, it was 1.7%. And if they lent it to our scheme at 2.5%, we could start building immediately to self-supply housing for ourselves. And it would build communities, you know, build our own assets. And when we come to retire, we can then utilise the asset we built up in the pension scheme to pay rent while we're no longer working, and give us an income stream. And it would all be kept locally.
Just back on to sort of materials and climate crisis and building houses, I think there's a really interesting correlation between between when people move from building houses with really local, sustainable materials in really traditional ways to building houses with bricks and cement, all that stuff, with people moving into cities and being obliged to sell all of their labour and having no more time. So the expectation of what a house needs to be in terms of being something that you just build and then it's a thing that stays there forever, like a shiny pebble that doesn't need to be touched or doesn't need any stewardship, kind of limits people's imagination in terms of the houses you can build and how efficient they can be and how sustainable they can be. And I think if you can fix the fact that people don't have time or don't have any idea that they need to steward land and houses that they live in, then you could start to think about the materials you use and build really exciting houses.
Just to lead on from that, like we've been thinking about a lot around what is a house, what is a home, because one of the biggest problems that we face and the tiny homes community face is that UK planning law doesn't recognise our homes as homes, as a suitable living space, basically, because of the space requirements in UK planning law. In England's planning law, it means that actually, even if you built a tiny home, or if you wanted to like legitimately set up a community with vehicles as homes, it would be really, really hard for us to get planning even for like a temporary building because we don't meet their space requirements. And so that's our first problem, is actually like if you're going to start developing alternative housing and alternative ways of living, it's kind of what Tom was saying earlier, it's actually that top down, because we are like fighting UK planning law from the start to be recognised as a housing option. And also there are things that can be done a little bit, like when we met with Paul Smith, the Cabinet Member for Housing in Bristol. He said that they're working on trying to take the space in communal facilities as part of your housing space, so that, you know, we could live in our tiny little vehicle or home, but if you've got workshops and, you know, like a communal kitchen and things like that, they would take that into account. It's still really hard to hit the space requirements, but potentially possible if you've got people that are kind of willing to like work around it a little bit as well.
Amazing. Have you seen how big the spaces students have to live in are? Basically, it's just a bedroom, and you've got a seventh share in a tiny living room come dining. I mean, I don't understand how that is more space than you've got, even. But, I mean, there's this whole thing of think global, act local. How do we change policy in this city? At the moment, we've got these two developments going on, which is the potential, anyway, Temple Island and the proposals for the Western Harbour. Around those areas, there are communities who are disgusted by the plans that there are by the people that own the land next to them. And there's already an enormous campaign building, particularly on Western Harbour. So I think it behoves everyone here who's a Bristol resident to hook up with that existing campaign. This is one of the things that we in the 1990s did, which was such a lot of fun, is we'd find a tiny local campaign fighting a supermarket, as we did it in Wandsworth, and we would say, well, how would you like it if 300, 400 people turned up to back your campaign? And of course they loved it. And that's the sort of thing a movement like Land Justice Network can do, is come in behind a good campaign. The Western Harbour, if anyone has seen it, is a horrendous development, incredibly high density, almost no affordable housing going to be in there at all. And so looking at identifying existing bad developments is quite a good way to hook up with your lovely local residents who are desperately trying to fight something like that. And if they can see that there's a wider movement out there supporting them, it gives them an enormous morale boost.
Thanks. So my name's Gemma and I am a planner. And a few contributions back, we started to talk about what the role of the planning system is, and I just wanted to add a few thoughts on that, really. So I work with the baddies. I work with developers and planning authorities every day. I work closely with the West of England Combined Authority, Bristol City Council, but also nationally with the Ministry of Housing. And the people we're talking about, where the source of problem happens. So yeah, top down. But what do I do with them? I actually try and bring a voice to the table that's actually been missing quite a lot, even in this fishbowl, which is nature. So the first company I set up for myself was called At Home on the Earth, because when I saw this topic, I was like, housing, yeah, fine. Housing is super topical. We need to talk about it. But is it housing or is it homes? And I know a lot of people have been talking about homes, and that's actually what we all want. We don't want bricks and mortar. We want somewhere to live and be able to go back and be safe and be warm and gather and we have communities. So we can talk about homes, we can talk about communities. I think that's actually what we're talking about here, is the mechanics to get to the place that we need to be to feel who we are and be who we are and flourish and aspire and so on. So it's the community, it's the stewardship. Then what we're talking about, we're talking about mental health, and we're actually reversing the trends of loneliness. That's actually what housing is all about. So for me, the connector, because actually it's so much about connection what we're talking about. We can get lost in the detail and we love, you know, being geeky, and but it's, you know, we're talking about just being alive and, you know, being in love and being connected. It's nature, right? So everyone knows how good you feel when you reconnect with nature. And there's stuff going on at these levels where it's about power. I'm coming to that. Like, there's this concept that's recently come through the Environment Bill, the Wildlife Trust. I work for the Wildlife Trust movement. The Wildlife Trust have this concept called Nature Recovery Network. So the question I want to kind of, in my very characteristic, long-winded, winding way, get us to is, where do we want to live? So where do we want our homes to be? Where do we need our houses to be? Because we are in a crisis. We're in a, not just a climate crisis, but an ecological crisis. Biodiversity is catastrophically declining. And we that's us. It's a psychosis to think we're not part of nature. You know, and so that's in my head, and like housing, home, that's like the psychosis split. We're part of everything, right? So when we kill the land, we kill ourselves. So we need that land connection back. And there is a group of like organizations, partners called the West of England Nature Partnership. I don't know if people know about it. If you don't, it's thinking about what table you want to be at to bring the power to, yeah? And to speak truth to power. So where do you focus your power at? Which table do you need to get at? And we need to be thinking about land allocation as much as when you get to the end of the pipe, where are we actually deciding, you know, and it's everyone here has been talking about this, it's brilliant. So where do we want to live? How do we want to live? But let's keep the land underneath the housing, not just in the kind of brilliant models that Beth was showing us, but just in our hearts, in our minds, when we're actually making these contributions.
Amazing, and I need to talk to you a lot more. Just really quickly, we've recently realised that we need to, and we are going to be taking a nature-first approach with all of our homes and communities that we build. And that's what this piece of land is teaching us at the moment that we're working with, because it's already really biodiverse. And it's teaching us that's what we need to do, so that's what we're going to do. And I'm in conversation with Ian Barrett, the CEO of Open Wildlife Trust. He's coming to help us learn how to do it. So we're on the case.
Sorry, what were you doing?
Gemma.
I have a question for you, just around the Greenbelt and planning. Because my understanding is that the Greenbelt was set up to, obviously, to protect rural areas, but also so that people in urban areas can easily access rural areas. And in my opinion, at the moment, no one has access to hardly any of that because it's owned by people and they can't get on the land. And that's going to get worse if the government consultation goes through. So it's really to pose a question. If we were creating low-impact, affordable, obviously, but low-impact, environmentally sound and nature-driven communities, that would actually improve and increase biodiversity on the land. Do you see that that would be a reasonable option to be putting those on green belt land? Because for me, I called the planning office over in Baines to ask this question about some land that was for sale, because I don't want to be responsible for helping to develop the green belt or to make it easier for developers to come in at a later date, having, you know, us put some sort of like community on it. But she said you can put clauses into it. So even if we got, you know, permission to be on Greenbelt to create something that was biodiverse, community-led, affordable, etc., you could stop developers coming in. So do you think that kind of model is an option, or do you think it's too risky in regards to, like, development of Greenbelt?
All right.
Okay, it's a hot topic, and when you're a planning student, it's like, oh, I don't touch the green belt. But essentially, I think it came through in 1947 Town and Country Planning Act, and it had a very kind of distinct purpose, which was historical in the moment, and it's not fit for purpose anymore. So the most progressive planning authorities are trying to gently evolve the green, how they're approaching their local plan is to Greenbelt. However, the big resistance and pushback is always elected members who have vested interests in that land. But there's absolutely, there are mechanisms in the planning system, like you're saying, the clauses, but on a principle basis, if you take somewhere like Oxford, the reason so many unsustainable developments are happening, you know, someone mentioned eco-villages before, infrastructure, so, you know, that's not eco, that's not sustainable, because if you just like plop a new 2,000 home development in the middle of the countryside, you then have to create, unless you have like an old train station you could open back up, fine, that's different. But Oxford, the best thing Oxford could do is build on the green belt, but they won't because it's sacrosanct. Yeah. And so then you just got people driving back and forth every day because all the jobs are in the city. So I think we do need to gently push with some kind of precedents and pilots, so we can have an offline conversation. Cool, yeah.
Yeah, cool. I just want to come back on, there's a few points that were made then that I kind of want to bring back in. The laws, right? So like kind of trying to fit yourself within all of the legislation is difficult. And how do you do that? And how do you get laws that help you do the work that you do, right? And also, I can't see where it's gone. Yeah, collective action. Yeah. So like direct action, forcing people to do stuff that you need them to do. It comes back to this point of power that you were just talking about, right? That there's a lot of expertise in this room. A lot of people talked about materials, a lot of policy people like yourself, right? And there was a lot of great policies that were in the Labour Party's manifesto in the last election. But the difficult thing is there is no shortcut, right? That we know what we need to do. And the people who oppose us, and there are people who oppose us, and this is the thing that people need to bear in mind. They know what they need to do to help us as well, but they're not going to do it because they're exploiting us for money. This is the top line thing. They're exploiting land for money. They're exploiting the people who live on that land for money. So what can we do? We have to build power in communities to force the issue with these people. Acorn has got a model that works. And we've won. We win all the time, actually, whether it's keeping tenants in their houses, stopping bailiffs from evicting them, getting repairs done to those houses, all the way through to, they were going to build a gas power station next to a nursery in St. Phillips, which is a smart thing to try and do, obviously, in one of the more polluted parts of the city. And we organised collectively to squash that planning permission. All the way through to taking on high street banks, right? So Santander, NatWest, TSB had in their buy-to-let mortgages discriminatory no DSS clauses, which meant that anybody who was in receipt of any kind of benefit wasn't allowed to rent houses. So, you know, where are people supposed to live? And through collective action, through our union across the country, we've got branches all over the country now. We're like, must be one of the fastest growing unions in the country. We occupied those banks and we forced them to remove that policy. And when you can take on banks and force them to change their policies, then you can take on just about anybody and force them to change their policies, right? And make laws that work for us. But we are the way we do that is by building power through that union. So join the union, link up your campaigns with us, and yeah, we can start making these changes now. So come speak to me afterwards if you're interested in joining.
Over the past few years, I started thinking about rent and what rent is. And the more I was thinking about it, the more crazy it really seems when you break it down to its fundamentals, especially like market, commercial market value, rent. Because what it is essentially when you're renting, you don't have. So, you know, in a buy-to-let situation, you are paying for somebody else's asset to be bought. You don't have any rights over that asset. You don't have any credit score, which you get with having a mortgage or something like that. You know, essentially the rent of the house is paying for the mortgage, so somebody's have an asset. Then on top of that, there's also like sometimes a profit, which they're trying to make as well. So you're not only buying them an asset, you're giving them a profit as well, and then you're covering maintenance and bills on top of that. It's just like, when you look at it like that, it's crazy. It's a crazy situation. And I don't know what, you know, the only way I've thought that could be fairer is if when you're paying rent, you are always buying into the asset somehow, but how the fuck do you do that as a legal structure? And like, you know, how do you proportion the ownership of something over based on how much you pay? That's crazy, like that gets crazy complicated anyway. So, I don't know what, yeah, that's kind of as far as I got. But yeah, I'm in a situation with the house that I share with some friends where, you know, my parents, you know, in a lucky situation, my parents bought it, and so the rent is below market valuation, and, you know, although I haven't put the agreements into place, I want to do it in a way that people have a share of what, based on the proportion of what they paid, a share of the building, you know, like a kind of co-op structure. But how that could be more, you know, a more widespread thing in the general housing market, it's just, I haven't thought of how that could work, but maybe somebody
has some ideas.
There is a model called mutual home ownership, which I don't know loads about, where I work, I think helped come up with the idea, and so I should know more about it. And it's on our website. So lots of talk about some really exciting kind of like green shoots ideas, or like cracks where the light gets in the current system. Which is really exciting, and also like really important, like talk about power and how we need to build alternative structures of power in order to change things. I guess the truism is that power doesn't cede anything without a demand, and so I thought it might be useful to say a few things that like I feel that, you know, these alternative structures that are power that we're building today through, you know, the land justice movement and we both build through the renters movement with my involvement. in London, the London Renters Union, which works alongside ACORD, what should we be demanding? Beth already touched on some of this earlier. So, you know, if we're fighting the financialisation of land, what do we need? Simplistically, we need more affordable land. So we need a change to the mechanisms by which land is priced. I won't go into the detail because Beth did earlier, but we need to be enabling public bodies and other bodies building for or using land for social benefit to be able to access land at their existing use value, the price that they, the price that they have as a farm, as opposed to the massively inflated price that they're currently allowed to charge. So what's that? That's one demand. The second. I think at a kind of economics level, we need to ask the government to stop investing in housing demand and start investing in housing supply again, or housing creation, in light of what I said earlier about climate change. So the vast majority of the money that the government spends on housing policy, it still spends, even in, you know, neoliberal times, still spends a vast amount of money. It spends subsidising demand, so it spends on housing benefits, so paying people's rent for them, or on various forms of subsidy to help people buy homes. And the effect of this is primarily to push up the prices of rents and to push up the prices of homes. What it did for much of the 20th century and should do again is invest in supply, so council housing being the most obvious example. So we should demand that the government, you know, starts to flip that ratio back round and starts to invest in social rented housing and also forms of community-led housing. And then finally, the people who experience the vast majority of people who experience the sharp end of the housing crisis, if they're in a home, are in the private rented sector. Private renting is the tenure of poverty in this country. Much more people in poverty live in the private rented sector than live in the social housing sector. And as Beth said earlier, private renting has the worst rights and security and often affordability in Europe. The renters movement, including London Renters Union and ACORN, and assisted by the New Economics Foundation, wrote a manifesto for the last election, and this I think has about 10 to 12 policies which outline how to solve the problem of the private rented sector, how to make private renting affordable and secure, and ultimately how to, over time, get rid of it.
Where can that manifesto be found?
Google Renters Manifesto.
Yeah.
Something
just
like
on
that. There's actually an old one which wasn't very good, and I think it was made by Generation Rent, who are now much better. So make sure you type in Renters Manifesto 2019.
Yeah. So just to say, Beth's still got some summary documents for the land for the menu at the back, if you want to go and grab one of those.
Sorry.
We've just got over 5 minutes left, so we're not going to have any more people coming and joining the centre circle. We're going to just be wrapping up.
Thank you. Hi, sorry. I came in like about halfway through, so if anyone has said this already, I'm sorry, but I just wanted to kind of bring to the table the One Planet initiative in Wales, which is kind of very interesting in regards to like how we use land and the planning rules around that development, which is actually about how you use the land in terms of infrastructure, as someone mentioned earlier. I just forgot what the other thing was. The thing that I really wanted to say was really related to what Gemma said earlier about being connected to who you are and what we are, and really like what we actually want to be or who we want to be. Is a lot to do with how we use the land and the resources we have. And I was thinking the other week, short little story, but I got sepsis, and I got it the result of an injury, a serious injury. And what happened was a bacteria that usually lives symbiotically on our skin got into my body and then wanted to rapidly multiply and then, as a result, potentially kill me, which means that it would eventually end its own life as well. And I thought as a philosophy and perhaps a kind of like a way to move forward that what a lot of theories or what a lot of self-help books say is that, our actions are a result of our core beliefs. And really all that matters are our actions in the moment, here and now, because that's then what causes repercussions to the reality that we all sort of collectively experience. So I thought, well, what about as a philosophy or an idea to put out to people is like a question. Are we like a parasite of the planet, or are we a symbiotic organism? Because throughout nature, you see this everywhere. You see creatures that exist symbiotically or like natural organisms, and they live in harmony, and they sort of nourish and create more, and life grows. And then you see organisms that don't do that, and then there's turmoil, and then sometimes destruction. And that was the question I just thought I'd put out there.
Bravo to that. And I just want to say a big bravo to Jess, who has been sitting scribbling throughout this entire conversation and has made this very, very beautiful thing that we will put up on the wall that has a lot of the different groups and projects and ideas that have come out of this conversation, which I have really enjoyed. And I really want to say thank you to everyone for helping make this happen.
I mean, it's what you're saying is like a slightly kind of hippie thing, but you're absolutely right. That if anyone is interested, there's an economist called Michael Hudson in the States, who was a top banker who's now kind of gone rogue. He did a book about the financial system called Killing the Host. So if we are killing the host, it's because we're following what the financial system is trying to tell us to do. In other words, our values, our financial values, we're making our decisions based on how much money we're going to get out of it. So I would suggest anyone that is interested in how the finance system really works, don't take any notice of any of the financial journalists. Get hold of Michael Hudson's Killing the Host, because that's what they're doing.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, yeah, we have now finished our housing fishbowl, the first fishbowl down here. Thank you, everybody!
Thank you to Maria for facilitating that.
So we're now going to have lunch in here, and just a time pressure thing, we are starting the next session here in at 2 o'clock, and that will be on food and fibre will be the theme of that fishbowl. So we have 1 hour to eat food, get food, eat food, and clean up food. So enjoy your lunch.